There's a lot of stuff up here.
Hi, my name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm pretty glad to be sober today, and glad to be here tonight. I did think that driving up in the rain was really heroic. And I'm calm enough to know that it's 90 miles and it's going to take time and it's going to go slow. So I left in plenty of time, and I just think that's such a good experience. I haven't always done that. I'm not good on space and time. And I live in Oakland, and if you know the Bay Area, you know there's Redwood City and San Mateo in the West Bay, and every so often I'm asked to go over there and speak at a meeting, and I can never remember that it's 45 minutes. I think it's 20. I think it's 20 minutes from my house to the San Francisco airport. This is not true. It's 45 minutes. It has been 45 minutes from my house for the 20 years I've lived where I've lived, and I cannot remember this two times in a row. So a lot of times I head over, I'm leaving late because I answered the phone, and there's sweat and perspiration, and there's no gas and high anxiety, and I am capable of this behavior, and today, rain, before I left Oakland, I filled up the gas tank, and I dropped some letters off at the post office that should be in soon, and drove up here observing speed limits, and there was only one death-defying moment in the rain, and it was dark, and two of us tried to get into the same lane, but we were both sober. So we noticed, you know. And so that's my status. Anyway, I'm glad to be here tonight, and thank you, Nicole, for sharing. I identify with any number of odd behaviors. When people talk about odd behavior, I pretty much relax right away. I have been to meetings where people have discussed their virtues, and I feel out of place in the wrong meeting, and you know. So, welcome. There are new people here. There may be some visitors. Let me start by saying, as Nicole did, you know, I speak for myself. And if there's something I say you don't agree with, that's fine. That doesn't mean we have to have a purge of the program, and we don't... AA doesn't excommunicate or purge. It's really a good thing. And we don't throw people out for bad attitudes. That's another really good thing. And if I do say something you disagree with, that's fine. You don't have to mention it to me after the meeting. You can work it out with your sponsor, you know, later on, and let me be wrong, and we'll get along just fine. What else is... I was newly sober a couple of years, and I went down to, I lived in Los Angeles for 4 years sober. And I went to a meeting one night, a Sunday night speaker meeting, a 1 hour meeting. And this guy spoke, and he was quick and funny and fast and smart, and I really liked this talk. I mean, it was organized, and he just moved, and I was quite impressed. And this meeting brought the same people back every year. It was a pretty stable meeting. And the next year, this guy came back again, and I couldn't wait to hear him, and he said exactly the same thing. And I went, "You mean they memorize their talks?" Which kind of surprised me. So I've never memorized my talk, and if you've heard me before, I hope I say some different stuff tonight, and you know, take what you need and leave the rest. I was starting to speak at meetings down in Los Angeles, and the service commitment I had was the telephone answerer on every other Tuesday night from 8 o'clock to midnight at central office. And we weren't sophisticated so that phone calls would get sent to your home. You had to go to central office, which was downtown L.A., which is right where I lived, so that was fine. And there was another guy that worked with me for the 3 years, 4 years we did it, Tom B., who was from Pasadena, and He was a fellow who drank himself off the Los Angeles Times, which he always thought was hard work. And over 2 years of being together, we became good friends, and we were very different people. But anyway, one night, it was a Sunday night, and I spoke for the very first, one of the very first times at a big meeting in Pasadena. And then that next Tuesday night, I was answering phones at central office. And someone called, it was a lady, and she had had a couple of social drinks. And she was a little moody and a little unhappy. And so I have a counselor's voice that just goes right into a, you know, you make cooing sounds and soft things and not confrontational. And I was doing that. And I tried to pull out a few details from her. Had she ever been to meetings? And she said she had been to a meeting. In fact, just Sunday night, she was at an AA speaker meeting in Pasadena. And I said, "What place?" And she mentioned the place. And I said, "I was the speaker." And I, you know, to my mind, I was saying, "Isn't this coincidence and God working, you know, and all this stuff, serendipity?" Page 449, and third edition, 449. She paused and just said, "You were that twit." And I remember thinking, if AA hangs up on you, you know what? Where do you go? So I didn't hang up, but my balloon was sure deflated by this person, and I hope she's sober today. So you know what it was like, and what it's like now. The traditions are read at meetings. I think that's a good thing, and this is part of traditions. You know, the highest rank you get in AA is sober. It's important to remember. There are some places we forget that, and we think if you have longer sobriety, you are clearly a role model, and that's not always true. You know, the highest rank you get is sober, and every member of the program owns one share of stock. We're equal owners and equal members. And there are newcomers who speak the truth, and there are old-timers who speak nonsense. And the hat goes back and forth. And I like that. I heard in the East Bay that the reason the program works so well is that we're not all crazy on the same day. But there are days when you're just nuts. Days when I have been just pathetic. 2 weeks ago, I mean, we've gone through the Christmas marathon, you know, or the kind of like the Bataan Death March for some of us, but the week before Christmas, one of my teeth dissolved and I had a root canal. And it started falling apart on Friday, and Monday I called the dentist and went to see the dentist. And Monday afternoon I was supposed to go and see a good friend of mine, a good friend of ours, a woman who's been sober a long, long time named Burl. And Burl ran central office in Oakland for years and years and years. And Burl has lung cancer, and Burl is dying, and Burl hospice is connected with Burl. And I was going to go see her Monday afternoon, but I had this tooth problem. So I completely forgot about her. I mean, she's dying, but my tooth hurts. So I guess Monday late afternoon, I listened to my answering machine, and she was there, and she says, "Tom, do I have the wrong day?" And I thought immediately of calling her back and saying, "Yes, you do. You do have the wrong day, and I'm glad you're admitting your faults." But I find a step I've been using a lot lately is number 10. And I called her back, and I says, "No, you have the right day." And I said, "Burl, I want you to know, I know you're dying, but my tooth really hurts, and I'm useless for a couple of days." And so she said, "We'll call back when it's done." So Tuesday I went to the dentist, and he said, "Root canal," and, you know, so we're going to drill and things. And just talking about that for a second, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, all I could think about was my tooth. And I chaired a meeting Tuesday night in Oakland, and I wanted to have as the topic my tooth. And I want you to tell me about my tooth, and I'll correct you. Just completely took up my whole head. And I find that the pain is real, and the doctor gave me pain medication and let me go out on a very controversial subject here and just say that to the best of my ability, Alcoholics Anonymous is not Christian Science. And pain medication is for pain. So I took it as directed. You know, when you're ready to pass out, take medication. And I stayed on Vicodin for a couple of days, and it enabled me to live. And then on by Thursday, things were pretty much fixed with the tooth, 90%. And by Friday, there was no more need for the Vicodin. But I talked to my brother, who's also a sober alcoholic, and he also had a root canal, and he didn't take any medicine at all. And I said, well, good for you. I wish you well, but I think I had a better time with my root canal than you did with yours. So, pain medications for pain. It's a great insight. Then I went to see Burl, and we did talk on Friday and spent some time visiting, and I was able to take the attention off of me to her and asked her how her week was and how things were, and I'm going to go see her again on Monday, and we stay in touch. But when I'm real sick, it takes up everything. It just takes up everything. So that's true. Talk about drinking. I think at an AA meeting, you should mention that you drank. I was at a meeting not long ago when this guy talked, and he never mentioned his drinking. And I it just confused me. He talked a lot about his issues, because we are in California, but he never talked about his drinking. And I just think it's a good thing to mention drinking. So I stand before you as a falling down drunk. I was a daily drinker for a long, long time. Beer is my idea of a good time. Wine, spirits, any of it, I just find wonderful. Nicole said that she didn't like gin at first. My first experience with gin was sublime. It was an instant love affair. I knew this helped more than anyone should know about. And I knew that if you knew how much this helped, you'd take it away. So I wasn't going to talk about it. I really liked it. And for a period of time, I mean, it's not just enough for me to drink. I like to drink and feel sophisticated and smart. That's real and suave. I love all that stuff. And like I say, I'm a falling down drunk. So it's a little difficult to be suave when you keep falling down. But it didn't bother me at all. I spent a whole year in college doing martinis and Chinese food. And to this moment, I still think that the martini glass shape is a geometrically perfect design. And when I see one, I tears come to my eyes, and I want to thank the inventor for making that shape. There is something about it. It's like Mount Rushmore. My eye is drawn to it right away. A couple years ago, I was somewhere in the West Bay, and a group of us went out for dinner. There were four sober fellows, each of whom goes to meetings in this group. But none of us had ever been to this restaurant, and it's a kind of a fashionable place for the young and the restless. And this place featured double and triple martinis with glasses of appropriate size, and guys are breathing on these ladies asking what their astrological sign is. I mean, it's kind of interesting. So we're there to eat, and we're having food, but all of a sudden I noticed the martini glasses, and I'll tell you, it was all I could do. I wanted to leave my boring, stupid, sober friends and go over to the martini drinkers and say, could I just hold your glass for a few moments? You know, I'll give it to you when you want, but I just like to hold it. Now, this is like over 20 years of sobriety. And this indicates that for some of us, when we say daily reprieve, we really mean it. I'm one of those people, daily reprieve. It's not enough for me just to say, I'm sober today. I ask God for the desire to be sober today. I want to look forward to be sober today. I want to see being sober today as a good experience. I need all of that. I got an email today from somebody who's had a very tough time staying sober and has been in and out several times and is 10 months dry now and still feels no relief. Oh my, that's real hard. Dr. Bob says that in his story in the book, he says that for the first, I think, two and a half years of his recovery, he stayed pretty thirsty. And it was just, and other people, you know, were just, it went away right away. So I felt compassion for this poor person who's, you know, still dry, still missing it. I'm lucky in a couple of ways. One is I like meetings right away. I was also put into treatment. I was intervened on by members of my community, and they knew I was dying, and they knew I was a drunk. I thought I was a bad guy. And I thought if I just tried harder by myself, then it would be fine. And that just kills drunks. So I got intervened on, and I was put into treatment, and I went through a 21-day program. I'm very grateful for it. It was program-friendly. It took us out to meetings a couple times a week, to all the wrong meetings, but nevertheless to meetings. And once a week, there were two ladies of a certain age who would come in and talk about the program to us, one of whom was Burl, who has lung cancer now. And I remember when I met her, and this is 26 years ago, I remember saying, "What an old lady." I think she was around 46 at the time. And I said, "What an old lady, and no wonder she stopped drinking." I was 29 when I got sober. You know, so I was very aware of this age gap. And I thought that, you know, she probably was a housewife who didn't have a very interesting story. And then one night at a meeting, she told her story, and it made the hair stand up straight on the back of my neck. This was one, we're really glad she's sober, just on behalf of the safety of the state of California, I assure you. But I started going to meetings, and I liked meetings that were an hour and a half long. Shorter meetings I didn't like at all. Hour meetings, I was so wired and so tight that it took me an hour to relax after I got in the room. So I could only really hear the last half hour of a meeting. And I was just, you know, crazed. Now I like hour meetings. And I get cranky, you know, you'll notice as soon as it gets to an hour. I'll get visibly worse. At 8:30 to 10 o'clock, I was a nighttime drinker. I mean, I drank during the daytime too, of course, but nighttime really was my drinking time, and I had a lot of loneliness, and the way I managed my loneliness is I went to bars a lot at night, and I would hang out in bars, and I had several bars I truly loved, and of course, I didn't talk to anybody in bars. I was sober 5 or 6 years, and I read a book called Lost Weekend. They made a movie out of it with Ray Milland, which I've never been able to sit through. But it talks about a guy who starts drinking and binges all weekend. And the book goes into his head. I think the author's name is Jackson, and it was written in the 1930s, and there was a big discussion. Is he an alcoholic? Is he an alcoholic? And sometimes he said yes, and sometimes he says no. Who cares? In the book, he talks about my insides, and he talks about the way I think. And he's a very isolated guy with occasional problems with anger. He gets rid of his brother and sister-in-law, or his sister and brother-in-law, starts drinking, gets kind of lit, and goes out. And he wanders into a bar, and he sits at the bar. And behind the bar, of course, is a mirror. And there's all these other people in the room, but he's looking at their reflections in the mirror, and he has imaginary conversations with them in his brain while he's sitting there. I did that on a regular basis. And if you, and no, but no one had ever talked about that at meetings. And I'd been going to meetings for 5 or 6 years. But he had an imaginary life. I'm very social. I have many friends in the bar, in, you know, conversations in the mirror, rather like the myth of Plato's cave, for those of you with a classical education. But I remember reading that in his book, and it struck me, I mean, I identified, and I also knew that that behavior was very crazy and very isolated. And I had to put the book down and walk around the room. It's kind of like more will be revealed. And that happens at meetings every so often to me. Someone mentions something and I go, oh. One of my pals up in the Northwest is a sober priest named Stephen L., hopeless alcoholic of the worst kind. He's got about 15 years now. But he was at a men's stag meeting, and at men's stag meetings we talk about men's stag things, and they were going around the room doing this, and a couple of them talked about being Vietnam vets. And after the fourth or fifth guy talked about his Vietnam experience, Steve woke up a little bit and he said, you know, I think I was there. But I'm not sure. I have the vaguest recollection. He was there for 2 years. Blocked out. And it came back at a meeting. So one of the reasons I go to meetings is there's a lot to learn at meetings. There sure is. I have never done that. And my sponsor, who is a hopeless alcoholic of the worst kind, is of the opinion that at a meeting, if you're identifying with what people are saying, you're in a pretty good place spiritually. And if you are comparing, you're not in a very good place spiritually. And I'm pretty lucky. Recently, while I've been going to meetings, I've been identifying with people, even the craziest people in the room. On some level, I say, oh yeah, that's me. Every so often, someone speaks at a meeting and I go, they've lowered the standards. You know? We're letting garbage in now. Oh, when I got sober, we had a higher quality of drunk. And this is in the early pages. Let me see. There's a thing in the vision for you. This is a famous thing. You know, Bill and Bob are together and they're keeping each other sober. And they go out to look for member number three. And he's a lawyer who's sober. He's not sober. He's drying out again. And he's tied down in the bed. And the nurse describes him. This is on page 156 of the fourth edition. One day they called up the head nurse of a local hospital. They explained their need and inquired if she had a first-class alcoholic prospect. I swell with pride. She replied, yes, we've got a corker. He's just beaten up a couple of nurses. Goes off his head completely when he's drinking, but he's a grand chap when he's sober, though he's been in here 8 times in the last 6 months. Understand he was once a well-known lawyer in town, but just now we've got him strapped down tight. So that's just a very clear little moment. And then Bill writes, now Bill's been sober since November. And this is June. Bill writes, here was a prospect, all right, but by the description, none too promising. When Dr. Bob and I got sober, we didn't have people of this quality coming in. We were a higher quality of alcoholic, and now it's just garbage coming in, and the program's been in the toilet since 1936. You'll find these guys at meetings all the time. You know, basically, their class is the only one that amounted to anything. And gads. So when I identify with people, and I regularly, Nicole, at meetings, my home group, I don't talk very much. It's important for me to listen. And it's to listen to people talk about their insides and their thinking. And I was at a meeting once in Southern California. I was newly sober, big Saturday night flashy meeting at Cedars-Sinai Hospital. And the speaker there talked about he had an alcohol and drug problem, and he said that I took whites and then reds and then yellows and greens and blues and oranges and those and that, and he talked about what he did, not about what he felt. And I didn't identify with anything because I didn't do a lot of the same behavior. And I just kept waiting to relate to something, but his craziness was different from mine externally. But if he had talked about feeling angry or feeling lonely or feeling, you know, overwhelmed, or I could have related. So I just think that's important to do sometimes, to enter up that feeling world, that a world of emotion. I go to meetings and I like them, and I haven't always liked them. Sometimes I think everyone at meetings should go to more meetings. I moved from Oakland in 1977 to L.A., and I lived in Berkeley. I got sober in Berkeley, and that's where I met Bob. When he was brand new and sober, I saw him come in. I 20 people was a big meeting. And I was 29 when I came in, and I was lucky because right about that time in the mid-70s, a lot of women and men in their mid-20s and mid-30s were coming into recovery. 10 years earlier, it wasn't true. They thought you were a freak, and they would say things like, come back when you get more, and then you die, you know, not come back. So I had a lot of peers that I would follow, and if you go to 3 to 5 to 7 meetings a week, you met the fellowship. And there was a real feeling of support. You'd meet people walking down Telegraph Avenue and just, you know, like rats from sinking ships, you know. I went to L.A., and here's the rule, here's my experience. Wherever you get sober is where they do it right. And if you move anywhere, even across town, it's a crisis. Because they do it wrong. They read from the wrong parts of the books. They do birthdays wrong. They do sponsorship wrong. Don't these people know anything? And culturally, it's a huge upset. So I got sober in Berkeley AA, where we had dark lights, low lights, we smoked, and we didn't clap. Okay. I got sober in non-clapping AA. We were probably too depressed to clap, as looking back. And also, part of being sober is being very cool. You know, you had to be cool, and clapping was for yahoos. And we would have intellectual topics and talk about important things and use big words. Half the fellowship was trying to get their doctorates finished. I remember one time as a topic in Berkeley, we had sobriety as a fundamentally revolutionary act. That was the topic. It was just great. We all talked passionately, you know. So it reflects the neighborhood, you know. Anyway, I moved to L.A., huge meetings, well-lit, happy, upbeat, friendly. And I just went into a shock. They had greeters at the door. I mean, this is invasive. And they clapped for everything. They clapped for the Serenity Prayer. They clapped for the Lord's Prayer. They had these very elaborate birthday rituals that resembled the Academy Awards. I mean, it was amazing to me. And I had nowhere else to go, and there were like 1,000 meetings a week in L.A. County. This was in the 70s. I mean, just big, big meetings and lots of razzle-dazzle. It still is like that, and it helps lots of people. Terrified me culturally. And I talked to my sponsor, who's a hopeless alcoholic, and I said, are there any small meetings in L.A.? Because I had to meet somebody, you know. And he said, try a big book study. They're always small, and that's the rule. And so I started going to a big book study on Friday nights at a Korean church on Olympic Boulevard, and there were maybe 8 to 16 people regularly at that meeting. I was 30. They were all in their 40s and 50s and 60s. But they were regularly there, and they became my first friends. But I had been going to meetings for 6 months before I found them. So if you move, you have to do a lot of footwork to find a place where you can be at home. And I was so desperate, and that's a gift. Desperation is a gift. I was so desperate, I was in no place to say, gee, I don't like the way they do birthdays, I won't come back. Even if I didn't like the way they did birthdays. So I was there. And I had to participate, because if I didn't participate, I'm dead meat. So I started going to meetings, and I did a lot of stuff down there. About 2 years sober, I did my fourth and fifth step. I had been doing it for a while. Like, you can do the fourth step for a long time. And when people say, what step are you on? You can say, I'm on my fourth step. And they back right off. Okay. Because you know it takes months or years to, you know, get the final draft for the publication. Robert Redford wants to play me, you know, in the movie and all those things. I heard that if you did your fourth and fifth step, it helped you stay sober. And if you didn't do it, you'd drink again. And that was great motivation for me. Because I didn't know what sober looked like, but I knew what drunk looked like, and I never wanted to go back there. And I waited until I was really angry. I mean, I looked, you know, I read the book, and I went to some big book study things where step four was the topic, so I theoretically understood how you were supposed to do it, and I had paper and pencil, the right paper and the right pencil, you know, set aside. And I couldn't get three words done. And I went to a meeting, and the speaker was really a jerk. It just made me highly irritated. And everything about the meeting irritated me. And I went home in a white rage, and I started writing about resentments and anger. And I just did names, and I listed names of people I wanted to see slowly dead. And this guy, whoever it was, his name was at the top of the list. And I was upset and angry, and I could start just listing the names and then deal later with the, you know, why and my part and so, but just get the names down. And it started me doing the process. And I wrote until I was not miserable, and then I stopped writing. And then I think weeks went by. And something else upset me, and I went back, and when I was upset, I wrote. So my fourth step took about 18 months, but it wasn't 18 months of steady work. It was write for 2 days and then not touch it for 4 months. And then write for an evening and then put it away. And I finally, around 2 years, I said, I had better get this done because it's so pathetic. And I finished it off, and I made a date with my sponsor, and I said, will you hear my... I'd like to get the fifth step done. I'm very businesslike in this stuff. Let's get it done. And so he said, sure, and we made a date. And I took a bit of a retreat for a week. And I went and I slept and I walked and I prayed a little bit and I wrote. And I finished my fourth step. And it wasn't long. It's not the great American novel. A lot of it was boring and repetitive, which is very embarrassing. You'd want something really awful, you know, that you're reading to whoever's listening and every so often they have to walk around the room or call their sponsor or, you know, go to the bathroom and throw up. I mean, something, you know. But I just didn't have much of that in there. I had some stuff that sure embarrassed me. And there was stuff there that I hadn't told anybody. But it wasn't really horrifying. Not a single bank heist or axe murder in the list, I'm sorry to say. And I got together with my sponsor and I read him this stuff, and it took about an hour. And at the end, I just felt done. Exact nature of my wrongs. And I had stuff with anger, still do. I had stuff with resentment, still do. Had stuff with overwork and sloppiness, still do. You know, grandiosity, yeah, that's me. A lot of this stuff. And I talked about it. I followed the list here in Bill's account, the resentments, the fears, the sexual stuff, and in the 12 and 12, he does some writing about finances. And there were some people I owed money to. There were some people I had borrowed money from. There were some people who, because of me, had gotten into financial trouble. Not vast numbers of monies, but enough that I knew. And this was stuff I had to clear up. So my sponsor just listened. He does that. He's one of these introverted types who listens. So you never know what they're thinking. And he listened, and I think he looked bored, and he stared at the ceiling. Then I was finished, and he said, well, there was a momentary pause, of course, while he gathered his few thoughts. He said, one thing's real clear. And I remember just cringing, waiting for this blow. This, oh, no, you know, something's clear. And he said, both you and I need this program very much. And then he got up and left. And I was just thrilled to see him go. I really was. And that's how I understand it. I mean, it says we admitted. It doesn't say we admitted and then discussed. It just, we admitted. To God, ourselves, and another human being. Some sponsors don't qualify. If they're not human beings, you don't have to do your fifth step with them. It's for our sake. It's not for your sponsor's ego. So find someone you can talk to. And if you're the person who hears the fifth step, the most important thing you can do is listen. And then, of course, keep your big fat mouth shut afterwards. Part of the tradition I'm raised in is anything said in confidence needs to be kept confidential. There's a guy in L.A., he's dead now, died sober of HIV. His name was Jostler. He's been dead now 8 or 10 years. But he talked about gossipy AA, because sometimes we are. And he would say, anonymity is anonymity, but news is news. You know? And what I have to remember as a member, is stuff that's said in confidence needs to be kept confidential. When I was, as you may know, I'm a Catholic priest. When I was ordained a priest 25 years ago, one of our teachers said, ask God to remove from your memory anything you've heard in confidence. And I've done that. And that's pretty true. I don't remember most things I've heard in confidence, which I think is real good. I was at a meeting in Chicago this past year, noontime meeting in the Water Tower District. And they read all the stuff, you know, chapter this and 12 these and 12 those. And then before the discussion began, they read a little thing that said, this is a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything you say here can and will be used against you in a court of law. And then the meeting started. I went, my goodness. And then people shared to the best of their abilities. I want to talk a little bit about defects of character tonight. I guess I've been talking about them all along. But I, in one of the stories in the book, I like the stories in the book, by the way, very much. You can get alcoholics fighting about anything, and some alcoholics think that only the first 164 pages will keep you sober, and this has not been my experience. I sometimes, when I haven't had a person to talk to, I have had a story to read in the back, and it's helped a lot. And in this one story in the back, it's from the very, very early days. I think it's been in all four editions, and it's the first guy from Chicago who got sober. And he gets into Akron, Ohio, and he hooks up with this early AA group, and it's all men, and it's about 10 guys. So this is 1936, 1937. They're all a little intense. But he meets with Dr. Bob. And Dr. Bob's great gift is one-on-one. Bill Wilson was not good on one-on-one at all. Bill Wilson liked groups. Dr. Bob didn't like groups at all, and thought that speaking in front of a group was the worst experience of his life. So there's very few instances where we have Dr. Bob talking in front of groups, but one-on-one, he was there. And the guy writes, this is in the fourth edition, this is on page 263. The day before I was due to go back to Chicago, it was Dr. Bob's afternoon off. He had me down to the office, and we spent 3 or 4 hours formally going through the six-step program as it was at that time. The six steps were, 1, complete deflation. 2, dependence and guidance from a higher power. 3, moral inventory. 4, confession. 5, restitution. 6, continued work with other alcoholics. Now, Bill will take those and come up with 12. Dr. Bob led me through all of these steps. At the moral inventory, he brought up several of my bad personality traits. Haven't you ever wanted to do that? You know, yes, I'm here to listen to you, but before you talk, let me talk. He brought up several of my bad personality traits or character defects, such as selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentment. I'll repeat that list. Selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentment. Bill W. had his list. Dr. Bob had his. And what I notice at 26 plus years sober, This is the stuff that makes me crazy today. And in the language of the steps, we talk about having defects of character removed, and I think there's maybe an understanding that they should be removed permanently and forever. And I just want to say this has not been my experience. My defects of character have not been removed. Rather, I get a daily reprieve. It's like my drinking. I get a daily reprieve. And when I'm doing some footwork and I ask help from God and I return phone calls and I try to be a good citizen, I'm not dangerous. And every so often I start cutting corners or going too fast and not taking enough time for hungry, angry, lonely, tired, and I find that my selfishness, my conceit, my jealousy, my carelessness, my intolerance, my ill temper, my sarcasm, or my resentments in any combination can take over the whole day. And I used to think that if I was in trouble, you know, bleeding and on fire, panic, difficulty, the pain that I was back at step one. And sometimes I have been. There have been times when the appropriate dosage is a dose of 1, 2, and 3. But I also notice this, there are times I'm pretty miserable and it's because of 6 and 7. It's the defects of character. And I have to ask God to remove the defects on a daily basis, daily reprieve, which are making me dangerous, unhappy, miserable. And it's very fragile. It's very fragile. I think there's a real wide road of human life that I want to live in. And there are times I look at my behavior, and if I go through something like I've cut back at meetings or I haven't gone to meetings for a while. I get brittle and jagged, and I lose all my resiliency. And I have to go back and do real basic footwork, like going to meetings and saying hello to newcomers and putting up with old timers to get some centered place and some flexibility and some balance. And that's the big difference. I heard someone from Orange County, of all places, say, each year of recovery gives you one more second of response time. So you got a year of recovery, stuff happens, boom, you've got a whole second before you have to do something, say something, think something, take action. 10 years, you've got 10 whole seconds. Now you might choose to do the same awful thing, you know, that kills you, but you've been able to think about it for a little while longer. And what time in the program does is it gives us a little more room and a little more time. And sometimes, like especially through the holidays, there are these tense situations, and in certain circumstances, I've had 26 seconds to remind myself to keep my big fat mouth shut, rather than let's clarify the issue. But I want to tell you that on Christmas Eve of this year, I was talking to my mom on the phone. I was going to be really a good citizen. I was going to see her that night, and I was going way out of my way to act like a grown-up. And she just got to me. She just got to me. It's not what she says. There's a tone of voice, and suddenly I'm 9 and mad. And so I want you to know that on Christmas Eve of this year, I hung up on my 94-year-old mother. And that was the better choice. And step 10, you know, when wrong, promptly admitting it, it took me a couple of hours, 3 or 4 hours. I wanted to make sure she was out of the house. And I talked to her answering machine, and I apologized for my bad behavior. And I thought I was going to point out to her why I hung up on her, but I didn't have to do that. And I got to take care of my side of the street without putting a spotlight on her side of the street, which doesn't help. So I'm not up here as a role model for countless millions, I assure you. We will get along a lot better if you see me as an example of what not to do, and you'll have a much better program. But I'll tell you, at 26 years sober, step 10 is a real useful step to know about. To when, not notice it doesn't say if wrong, it says when wrong, promptly admitting it. And prompt could be anywhere from 20 minutes to 6 years, you know, depending on the circumstance. I ask for a daily reprieve, and I ask for God's help on a daily basis, not just that I stay sober, but that I'd be willing to stay sober. And that's a good way to enter a new year. Thanks.